Thank you everyone for being able to make it here tonight. My name is Cameron Kirker and I'll be your facilitator, and what we're going to be discussing here tonight, as I'm sure you're all aware, is a Q&A session to get some insights into the Part 3 exam process and get some guidance. And we've got an esteemed panel here actually, and I might... don't sell yourselves short. And I might actually start by asking Marlon to just give yourself a short introduction and your top tip for students.
Top tip. No, you didn't prepare for me for this. So I'm Marlon. I work at Colonial First Aid, so I'm a portfolio manager there. I've been there for 10 years. So I teach the 5B course, so I'm the course tutor for the 5B course in the investments finance course. And I've done that for the last 4 or 5 years. I'm also going to be taking on the 5A course in the second semester, so anyone sitting that, you'll see me again. Prior to that, I've also been an exam marker for, you know, it was like 3 or 4 years as well. And before that, obviously, I sat the exams myself. So, you know, I was kind of where you guys were a good 10 years ago. Time really flies. So the top tip, I don't know, I haven't really thought about that. Top tip is to study. Like, it's, like, it might sound simple, but I think, I was talking to, sorry, I forgot her name, but I was talking before, one of the frustrations I always get as an exam marker is when there's a really, really simple question and people tend to overthink it, and the answer that they write down just kind of doesn't answer the question at all. So just being careful of stuff like that, saying, yeah, I think that's all I got.
Hello everyone, my name is Peter Corbett. I'm a life insurance actuary. I work with KPMG. I've been at KPMG for about 3 years. Prior to that I was with TAL, and then before that Zurich. I've held a range of roles across operations, pricing, capital, valuation. I've also helped out being assistant examiner for 2B. My top exam tip. When I was studying, one of the things that struck me was when you read the notes and the course material, how much of it really sinks in on your first read. And I would suggest probably very little. So how do you get that extra context and extra information? So one of the ways I went about it, and one of the ways I would suggest, is for each topic, especially where you're having trouble understanding the material, is who in my company can I talk to about this to get commercial understanding of the problem? Not only does that give you better context and real understanding, you might get a chance to play with some models, see how things really work. It also builds up your network and your profile across the company. And then when you do that for each particular topic and you reread the notes, I bet you'll understand them a lot better than you did the first time.
Hello, my name is Matt Ralph. I'm at AMP, where I'm the pricing head of pricing for the life insurance business. Prior to that, I was a pricing actuary at Suncorp in the GI team. So I've actually jumped the divide from GI to life a couple of years ago. And in terms of actuarial exams, so I did the UK exam, so I can't help you from a personal experience of having done the Australian exams, but I've been the assistant examiner for CAP for the last few years, and so that's my role. Bruce is my boss in that regard. My top tip, so this is a very CAP-specific top tip, so apologies for those who aren't CAP people yet, but you will be one day. So my top tip for CAP would be, there are lots of, you know, there's unlimited number of scenarios that you might be asked to work on in the exam. And looking at the last few papers might help you a little bit, but it's not going to cover the full breadth of the questions that you might get asked in the exam. So don't worry too much about being able to nail the last four papers. That's probably not the most important thing. So I would spend time thinking about what are all the different kinds of issues that might come up. And especially if, say, you're a pricing actuary, I would say go and spend some time with one of the valuation actuaries and find out from them what are the big issues for them at the moment. And if you're in valuation and vice versa, go and talk to the pricing actuaries and find out what are the big issues for them, and maybe try and put together a list of, say, 9 or 10 big issues that are facing life insurance or general insurance at the moment, and just work through. So you don't have an exam question, but pretend you do. If it's a question about, you know, price optimization in general insurance, who are the stakeholders? Okay, so just go through, start listing out the stakeholders, and try and see things through the perspective of each of those different stakeholders. So just have a go at doing that for a question. You know, it's a non-existent question, but imagine you had a question about that subject, and write down who are the stakeholders and what would they each be interested in, and just practice doing that a few times. And then when you get into the exam, that would be one of the first things I do. Once you've read the question and read it a second time and read it a third time, then do your stakeholders, write them down and think, how would they see this issue? So that would be my tip.
I'm Bruce Thompson. I'm a tutor in life insurance and examiner in CAP. I've worked in super and life insurance, but for a number of years now I've been self-employed as a consultant, and I'll do anything that they'll pay the bills for. It's interesting in that often I'll find myself being an expert witness acting against the general little life insurers, the big end of town, and you very much get to see the other side of the story. Prompted by Sophie a little earlier, I was going to say that my big tip was to do the course twice. Peter has pretty much said that already, so if doing it twice is a good idea, then I'm going to tell you twice. So he's done it once, and I'll tell you the same thing pretty much again. If you choose to do the course twice by sitting and failing and then passing the second time, that works. If you work hard and do the course twice for one sitting, that will probably work too. The point being, you need to put everything in context, and when you're reading chapter one, you need to have it in the context of chapter 20 or the readings that you've already seen. Otherwise, chapter one, you may not pick up all the nuances. And so doing the course twice is more than just learning what's there, it's cross-referencing. And people say, should I be reading the Australian Financial Review every morning? And my answer at my age is no. But my answer for you is probably yes, because an awful lot of it is drivel, but you will pick up gems along the way and you'll get background of what's happening out there in the wide world. And when you're in your 20s, you will pick up more than I will when I'm slightly out of my 20s.
Hi, my name is Chow. I work for PwC. I'm a general insurance person, but I also do a little bit of other stuff on the side. For the Institute, I'm the assistant examiner for 3B general insurance. I've done the multiple choice questions setting a few years ago. I did some marking as well, and most recently assistant examiner. I'm also on council, representing you guys, trying to make our education system better. So if you've got the survey that people have sent out, please fill it out and we'll take your feedback on board. My one top tip would be to read the question. So sometimes when we mark the answers that people give, we're surprised or not surprised to find that a lot of people don't actually answer the question. So some questions have multiple sentences. Now, some students only answer one or two of those sentences or one of those two or three actions. Sometimes when the question says list, people discuss. Of course, that's wasted time because you're only supposed to list. You only get the marks for listing. Sometimes when it says discuss, people list, in which case you don't get the marks because you haven't discussed. So make sure you read the question and answer the question.
Thanks, Chow. Matthew Aib, I'm a capital actuary at Commonshaw. So I've spent a lot of time in reserving and capital management. For the last 3 years, I've been doing general insurance 3A and 3B exam marking and forum moderating. So that's why they asked me to come along today. So top exam tip. I might tell you a little story. So if you think back to the Vietnam War, so this is a US military example. Over the years, the US had enjoyed, for no better use of a word, or a 10-to-1 exchange ratio. And when they say exchange ratio, they're talking about a kill ratio. And what that means is, for every one US pilot, they would take out 10 of the enemy. And so obviously that's how the US is winning wars. Now, when it came to the Vietnam War, that 10-to-1 ratio dropped down to 2-to-1. And so the US were scratching their heads thinking, what's going on? We've got the superior technology. Why are we losing? Why is our exchange ratio so much lower than what it has been? And, you know, after this had continued for such a long time, you know, the US actually called a ceasefire. And during that period of the ceasefire, for I think it was at least 6 to 12 months, there were two sets. There's two sets of pilots, right? You've got the Air Force and you've got the Navy. And the Air Force kept doing what they were doing in terms of their training program. So their training program was to teach the pilots all the specifics about what's in the plane. So they knew exactly how to use their equipment, what's on the dashboard, what does it mean, how does it all work together. Right, that's what the typical training was. Then on the Navy side, they said, very bravely, let's change the program. We're not gonna keep doing what we're doing because we've been doing that and we're losing. And I say losing because even though 2-to-1 means that they're ahead, technology adjusted, the Vietnamese were winning, right? Because the Americans had superior planes. So the Navy said, let's change what we're doing. And what they did was they changed the training program, and what they focused on, instead of focusing on the parameters of the plane, they focused on training the pilot, simulating the actual war environment. So they had a proper, you know, proper computer screens that it felt like they were in war. They were looking at enemy planes that looked like the Vietnamese planes. And lo and behold, in the next year, the exchange ratio went up to 12-to-1. And you've got a very nice baseline because you compare it back to the Air Force and theirs was still 2-to-1. So the point of the story is, for your exams, a bit of an extreme example, but for your exams, simulate the environment as well as you can, because if you're simulating the environment before you get in there, when you get in there, it's going to be much easier. I certainly did that. I simulated the environment as well as I could. I think it was, back when I was doing it, was 180 marks for 100, 100 marks for 180 minutes. And so it's a 1.8 minute per mark. And I used to train at 1.5. So I'm not sure what the numbers are these days, but you know, train harder before you get in there. So simulate the environment is my top tip.
So I might start just with the opening question that's to the panel, generally speaking, and this is from someone that can't be here this evening. And the question is, it's a loaded one, why is the most common advice I get to pass the course to focus on past papers rather than the course content? Is the course more about exam technique rather than the actual content? And this is open to the panel.
No, you have to know the content. But learning the content doesn't pass you the exam. It's like a doctor learning what is the cold. You know what the cold is, but you never get asked that question by the patient. The patient says, I've got a runny nose, I've got a sore throat, what have I got? That's the exam question. If you haven't seen that exam question, you haven't really practiced as an actuary, and you're not going to pass because you just know what the cold is.
Unfortunately, in the exam, we're asking you to do two things. One thing is to demonstrate that you know the course material. Okay, you've read the papers, you've understood the textbook, you can repeat it or use it to solve a problem or a spreadsheet or whatever it is, but we're asking you more than that. And what we're asking you is often the word judgment is used, but we're asking you, do you have background? Do you know how this question sits out there in the environment of the regulator or the customer or whatever it is that is involved in the problem? Can you solve this problem? Can you operate in the real world as an actuary? Because you don't have to be an actuary to read a textbook and memorise it. That's a necessary but not sufficient thing that you have to do to pass the exam. But we ask you more than that. Practicing past exams is a good way of recognising and getting a feel for this, hey, it's more than just what's in the textbook.
I think everyone here, panel included, is at a particular point on a continuum from, you know, nappies all the way through to the other end of life, and you learn all the way through and you learn different things in different ways along the way. So what works in high school might not work or doesn't work as well when you get later on in life. So I know I've got three kids in high school now, so I know that at high school it's a lot about just learn what you're told to learn and regurgitate it in the exam, and you'll get a great HSC mark. And then uni's a bit different to that, it's a little bit harder, and you're now in the next stage, which is, and as the other guys have said, so learning the course material is great, you've got to do it, but we're looking for a lot more than just knowing the course material. So the harder thing is being able to adjust your thinking to the question that's put in front of you, and the best way to practice that is to practice the past papers, not to just be able to regurgitate the course material.
Just to add to Matt's point, I always tell people, especially if you're repeating a subject, just be mindful of any bias in doing past papers. So if you're doing a past paper and you've done it the previous semester, how much of the solution that you're writing down is because you remembered it from the previous time? And do you really understand the problem and the context? And you get that context by doing things around the course, like talking to people in various departments in the company, reading the AFR, reading publications that come out from, say, ASIC or the Institute. It really is about, you know, solidifying that course material, and do you have the full and proper context of the material and the question?
Maybe just one more comment. A bit of a general insurance twist. So if you think about a general linear model, right, you've got 100% of data, and are you going to calibrate your model on 100% of the data? That's not usually what you do. What you do is you calibrate it on 70% of the data and you test it on 30. So what I'm trying to say is, if you think about the course content, think about that as your 70%, and the exams as another 30%, as the other 30%. So I've seen a lot of students, and even the ones that I'm helping now, that treat the past papers as course material. So almost read the question, then flick over and read the answer. But that's, you're not learning. So the whole concept of 70-30 is learn, test. So that's the whole concept of this, right? You're learning on the course material and you're testing on the exams, past exams. But yeah, as I said before, simulate the exam conditions as much as you can. So to the extent that you've got the butterflies in your stomach as you're sitting there doing it, and getting your timing right, and when you get into the exam, you'll be fine.
Just a final point. One thing that I did historically with people who reported to me who were doing exams, I would actually make up past exam questions for them. So they were brand new, things they hadn't seen before, situations they hadn't seen before. So it tested their raw understanding of material. And the chances are, if you do that, you'll get something that's relevant, because the person who's setting the question is probably going to set the question on something they're working on at the moment or something they worked on recently, and so it'll be relevant.
I'll now open it to the general audience. If whoever wants to ask a question, please put their hand up and just wait for a mic, and go ahead.
Hello, hi. My question is specific CAP. So I think that during the residential course that we've sort of get the idea that exact summary is very important. My question is, can you help me sort of understand how important that is to, in terms of when you judge pass versus a borderline versus a fail, and what is the criteria for a good executive summary? Thank you.
My first answer is no, I can't tell you exactly how many marks are in the executive summary or anything like that. However, as an example, I'm chief examiner, and so I'm third marker usually on papers. And when I've read the executive summary, I've usually got a pretty good idea whether or not this person's going to pass or fail. So there's an assumption that you've backed it up in your report, but your summary is the single most important part.
If you think that's unfair, then this CAP is commercial actuarial practice, and in the big wide world of commercial actuarial practice, that is how your work will be judged. So I agree with Bruce. I'm also the third marker on the papers I look at, and you do form a judgment pretty early on in reading. You already know they're a borderline case. You form a judgment pretty early on as whether you think they understand the issues or not. So I'd say it's very important.
Let's broaden that beyond CAP for a minute, where it's not quite as obvious that there's a summary and a justification or body of a report. Nevertheless, everything that you write in the exam is seen by a marker on a screen, right? And a first impression is important. I'll ask some of these others to add to it in a minute. But if it is clearly set out with a few headings underlined of the logical steps that you're taking through the process, then you're ahead of the game already, right? Whereas if it's a scroll of bits and pieces, right, they're going to be struggling to think that you have given a convincing answer. Gentlemen?
Yeah, absolutely. So in real life, right, and you write these reports and you have these executive summaries and you give this report to these people, so you can think about these people in real life, you know, they're your 60-year-old, you know, dad or grandmother or whatever, who probably don't understand actuarial studies or topics related to actuaries. They've got to understand, they've got to pick the thing up and this thing's got to be useful to them. So you've got to contextualize the problem. You've got to make recommendations that make sense. The thing has to flow. So if you just put random ideas on a sheet of paper, that's not going to fly in real life, and that's not going to pass you the exam. Your arguments have to be coherent. Your recommendations have to make sense to, you know, a 60-year-old grandmother, sort of thing, you know. And this sort of CAP course is training you to do that in the real world sense. Yeah.
The other part to the question was what makes a good executive summary. I can tell you what makes a bad executive summary, and that's where people chop bits of text out of their report and dump them into the first page in a sort of fairly, you know, somewhat logical order, but it's dense text. And then a whole missing piece, and then another bit of dense text. You've got to really summarise the clues in the name, so it's a summary. And you really got to, take a paragraph and think, how do I say that in one sentence or in, one dot point, as opposed to which are the most important paragraphs that I'm going to copy paste into my executive summary. That might be quick, but it's probably the most important thing you're going to do in that exam room on that day. And I would not make it the thing that I skimp my time with.
First impressions count in so many things.
Maybe, how many of you here review the work of other people on your team? when someone gives you a piece of work that doesn't look high quality, you don't want to look at it. You'll send it back and you'll say, can you please tidy up X, Y, and Z? Because I'm not going to figure it out or spend time figuring it out. It's the same for an exam marker. The exam marker shouldn't need to figure out what you're trying to say. So setting it out clearly, logically, with structure will enable the exam marker to, well, it sets a more favorable first impression. In the same way as if you're sending a paper to your manager or to the board looking for approval to do something, you want to set it out in a way that makes it as easy as possible for them to give you that approval.
So just adding to that, in terms of how it applies for things outside of CAP, so in investments, a lot of the long form answers that we get are discursive questions. So just to point about setting it out well, being an exam marker for 4 years, there's nothing more frustrating than to have one of these discursive answers that are all jumbled up. The best ones to answer, the best ones to be marking are the ones that are set out clearly, that are set out nicely. And not saying that there is necessarily a bias against. As a marker, we try to give you the marks that you deserve, but as a marker, you definitely want the candidate to prove that they know the answer. We're not going to guess whether you are. That answer sort of touches on a certain point. Maybe we'll give them half. We don't do that. So unless you actually hit that point exactly the way that it should be answered, you're not going to get the mark for it. And I think just as a marker, you can quite see quite clearly the difference between candidates that are confident in how they answer the questions. It will be set out in a form where they're clearly not trying to hide things. The ones that are more jumbled are clearly the candidates that are weaker, that don't know the exact answer, so they throw everything together in a big jumble and hope that something in there scores a mark. That's, from a marker's perspective, you're not going to get a mark for that. So that is a bit of a waste of time. So yeah, setting things out clearly, that is quite important.
And often when it's jumbled, the same point gets repeated as well, and you don't get 2 points for the same, two marks for the same point.
Maybe extending the topic a little bit here, but when I did a management course some years ago, I was taught that when you are asking one of your people to do a piece of work, you should instruct them in SMARTA, S-M-A-R-T-A. Some of you might have heard this before. And it's a mnemonic that helps you to say, and it works for your recommendations in a report, but SMARTA, S for specific, right? An instruction or a recommendation has to be specific, measurable, achievable, R is relevant, T is timed, right? It has to be done by next Thursday or a year from now, right? You have to say when it has to be done. And A is agreed, right? If we're talking about it and you're going to do something, you have to say, yes, I agree to do that, not no, I'm out of here, right? If your objectives are SMARTA, right, in exams, then you will cover all the bases. But you can use that on yourself. This week, what am I going to be doing with study? Right? Oh, I'll read the textbook a bit. Right? No. Set yourself something specific, measurable, achievable, right? And make sure that you do that. If it helps you, write it down. And I use SMARTA coaching soccer teams or teenagers or anything else. It means that they know and you know what's expected. Convince the examiner in the same way. Right? Make sure everything you say is SMARTA.
Hi, my name is Aidan. Thanks for you guys all sharing your time here to share some of your insights. I've got a question specifically for Peter, as the 2B assistant examiner. So you're the third person in the line when you're marking an exam, so no doubt you would have seen a lot of the borderline cases or mark discrepancies and that sort of stuff. So just wondering if you could answer within a 2B context, what do you feel like differentiates someone who barely passes and someone who just doesn't?
I
I think maybe I'll explain the role I've done on the exam. So I haven't actually marked the exams. I've helped set the exams rather than mark. So as to how they're marked, I can't really comment too much on that, I'm afraid.
Just generally applied, I guess, to whoever marks them.
Yeah, so how the process works is each question gets marked by two markers. The two markers, their marks can't differ by more than two marks or three marks. Otherwise, they have to agree as to why their marks have differed and then converge their marks. And then if the overall mark is a borderline case, then that gets reviewed by the exam team, which consists of the assistant examiners and the chief examiner. And the focus of those people is to look for what we call fitness to practice. So whether this candidate is fit to practice as an actuary. So it's sort of a judgmental call, but it does look at whether the candidate has demonstrated enough knowledge, application, and professional judgment in the quality of the answers that he or she has provided. And so if the candidate has done very well in demonstrating knowledge, but very poorly in exercising judgment, then that would be a borderline fail because that candidate has not demonstrated fitness to practice. However, if another candidate who achieved the same mark, demonstrated a lot of professional judgment, good quality judgment, however, missed out on some knowledge marks because of carelessness or whatever, and that person would be a borderline pass.
And just have a think about how can you put that, what can you do about it? So I knew this when I was in the exams, and I thought, well, what am I going to do about it? And what I did was I practiced. So when I used to write my answers to the exam, again, under exam conditions, I would read back over what I just wrote and ask myself, do you sound like you know what you're talking about? And you've got to be brutally honest with yourself. Sometimes it can be a little bit jumbled. Sometimes you've hit the point, okay, move on. What I tell a lot of the guys that I help now is read back over, ask yourself, do I sound like I know what I'm talking about? Ask yourself, so what? So I've made a point, so what? And that doesn't apply to the list questions like Chao was saying before. It applies more to the describe type of questions. But they're practically how you can sort of practice for when you get to the exam situation.
And probably there's a hint in there about how you would, if you've got a bit of time left to the exam, at the end of the exam, where would you spend that time? I would spend it on the judgment parts of the questions rather than the knowledge part of the questions.
So just to follow up on that, you said that you look specifically more for marks earned through judgment as opposed to knowledge and understanding. Would it be then fair to say that a higher proportion of marks, if candidate A had a higher proportion of marks in complex judgment criteria questions, that more often than not that they would be borderline pass as opposed to knowledge or understanding?
More likely, but in your knowledge part, you can't answer something that's blatantly wrong. So for example, if the question asked you what is profit, and you say, you know, it's my salary, then that's that's just a silly example, but that's obviously wrong. So that if you wrote that, that would be unfit to practice. So you've got to get everything, but you know, a key difference, I guess, between your part three exams and your part ones is the demonstration of professional judgment. So you have to get that right.
The other thing I'd say to the way you sort of phrase that sort of leads you down a pathway of having some magic formula sitting in the background that I don't know if that's what you meant, but just to be clear, that it's more of a overarching judgment rather than a let's go through the questions and separate them out into judgment questions versus non-judgment questions and decide whether that's probably not the process. I haven't marked the 2A or 3A, but it's more likely to be a sit back at the end as examiner and think, well, how do I feel about this candidate?
So I guess as opposed to like a measurable framework or whatnot in determining that.
No, so examiners exercise professional judgment as well. And so once you've seen a few, you know who's going to pass and who's not going to pass.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Students can be very creative in coming up with ways to fail. When we look at the marginal cases, we tend to see a higher ratio of them, right? But unfortunately, proofreading your own material is actually very difficult because your eyes skim over because you know what you wrote. And sometimes it's not quite what you actually wrote. And that's when we find people saying silly things that they wish they hadn't written. And sometimes you do an exam interview with somebody later and you go, oh, you said this cringe-worthy thing. And she'll go, no, I didn't. Oh, yes, I did. Proofreading your own material's quite important.
And if you have spare time studying, don't focus on how to become a borderline pass rather than a borderline fail. Try to become a clear pass. You know, if you're a clear pass, you're not going to... And we don't like borderline cases as well because it's more work, right?
Yes. Either pass or fail.
Yeah. So you know, you've got all this bunch of people sitting around trying to decide whether this candidate is going to pass or fail. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of misery for you guys as well because, you know, this year you're a borderline pass, next year you're a borderline fail. You're never a clear pass. It doesn't feel good, right? So you want to pass. And some of the things you can do are small things like answering the question. You'd be amazed to look at some of the answers that people give you. They can easily pick up 2 or 3 marks here and there by answering all parts of the question, but they didn't. So had they picked up those 2 or 3 marks, they would have been a clear pass instead of a borderline pass.
Yeah, that's actually another thing I also tell the guys that I help, is you've got to treat the exam like a dogfight. So like I was saying to... earlier in my opening speech, if you like, what the Vietnamese were doing, were getting into the dogfight, and that's why the Americans weren't doing so well, right? So when it comes to the exam, you've got to actually claw as many half marks as you can. Claw as many half marks as you can, because if you don't, someone else will, and that's going to put you below the borderline, if you like. So claw every half mark, and you're writing until the last minute. Yeah.
If we're doing military examples, the Australian Army's tank school, right, as in armoured tanks, had 3 divisions. And on the first day, they'd go into the first division and be taught all about communication. And they'd be told that without communication, it's useless having a tank because you don't know where you're supposed to go or what you're supposed to do. And on the second day, they'd go into mobility. And they'd be taught all about the engines and the tracks and how the tank moved and everything else, because without that, you'd be useless. And on the third day, they'd go into gunnery. And the guy would start off by saying, well, the others have told you how important they are, but hey, without gunnery, you've got a 60-ton mobile radio. Gunnery is the most important thing. And when you're studying, you need to focus on the most important things. Sure, you do have to know the other stuff, but you've got to focus on the most important thing. Reading the exam question, you have to do the same. What is the issue here? Not where do I get the few marks. Okay, I've got to do that, but why have they asked this question? Why have they set it out this way? What's the wrinkle? What's a bit different here? What's the point of this? My recommendation when I finish parts A, B, and C has got to solve their problem. What's the real issue behind this? What is the most important thing? And right from the start of your reading time in the exam, have that in your mind. What is the big picture, the most important thing that I've got to do to solve this problem or whatever it is?
So just following on that, a practice you can do is, over time, you read the paragraph in the question, right, when you do past papers, and then you try to guess what the questions are. Because when the writers write the questions, they ask you the questions that matter, the questions that hit the issue of the paragraph that's been described to you. So if you can come up with the questions, then you really understood the context of the question. And I also find APRA discussion papers really useful. So APRA would put out a discussion paper, and then people would put submissions. And you read the submissions, and they're all different perspectives, different people trying to hit the issue and thinking about, you know, different nuances of different elements of the issue. And you read that, and then you see APRA's response, and then another round of consultation, another round of submissions, and that really gets you thinking about, you know, issues and what's important.
And this is where we give away the exam questions that are coming up. Put yourself in, and I can do this because I'm not writing any 2A questions, for example. Put yourself in the examiner's shoes. It is quite difficult to write a sensible, creative question that is not straight from the bookwork and hasn't been done in the last 5 or more semesters. Okay, how do you come up with those sorts of ideas? What's an issue out there in the real world of general insurance, GRIS, life insurance? What has APRA just written a paper about? Ah, this might be the sort of thing that will prompt a question from the examiner.
Just to follow on from Bruce's point, writing an exam question is very, very difficult. You don't want to write an exam question where you're... And nobody wants to read an exam question that's got paragraphs and paragraphs of information. Every piece that you put in the exam question is relevant. That's why it's been put in. So ask yourself, well, why is that relevant? Why have they put that in? We haven't done it just to, you know, to show off knowledge or anything like that. It's relevant.
I'll give you an example, right? CTP reform that's just happened in New South Wales. Now, if you put yourself in the shoes of the government, the minister, what's the problem he's trying to solve, right? He's trying to give people a lower premium. But the problem is more than that, right? So he has to ask himself questions. He has to answer them. And if he failed, the consequences are real. You know, he gets out of office. So he has to think about, okay, what are the issues? The issues are fraud, legal representation, profits or whatever. And then he would form questions as to how to solve those problems, different options, different solutions, what are the merits, what are the pros and cons, how do we discuss this, you know, and then you can read all of the consultations that's been put out by people, all the submissions, the government's response. It really gets you thinking about the issue. So in a real exam, this is how the examiner sort of writes the question. So here's a hypothetical situation, very close to a real life situation, and the questions are the questions that the person in real life would have asked, and then you've got to come up with the answers.
Hi, I'm Ada. Thank you for your time tonight. My question is, do you actually mark to a curve? And if not, do you have any theories as to why for every subject, every semester, every year, so many students are missing out, more missing out than not?
Oh, I'll have a go at this one, Chow. It's a common question. I'm not doing exam marking now, but I have done it. And as has been mentioned before, you'll be very surprised that at some of the answers you get. There are clear fails. It's every single semester there's just clear fails, and it's just like there's no hope for this paper. It's gone. You know, you'd read some of the answers. It's just ridiculous, and you wonder even if they've studied. And I kind of have a theory. I'm sure people will disagree with me, but roughly 1/3 of people that pass will know both their knowledge and have good exam technique, and then you'll get a third that know their content but haven't got really good exam technique, or they've got a good exam technique but they haven't quite nailed the content, they're going to fail. And then you've just got the other people that are the clear fails because they don't know the content, they've got bad exam technique. And so it definitely does not get fitted to a distribution, but you'll be surprised at the answers that come through that are just clear fails. And, you know, when I was sitting it, I even wondered the same thing myself. And I said, you know what, I wonder if I can pass 80% this semester. But you just can't, because you look at the answers and you say, how am I going to pass this person? You know, they don't sound like they know what they're talking about. So that's what I was saying before, read back over your answer and said, do you think you sound like you know what you're talking about? Because that's what we're doing when we're marking. So
I think the answer for CAP is definitely no. We don't mark to a curve. And I can't think of anything less likely for us to do than to fail someone on the basis that we need to fail some more candidates because there were too many that passed. It's just unconscionable to do that. So it's definitely not how it's done.
I've shared Ada's curiosity for quite some semesters now about why is it that 50% of people fail, right, or more. Part of it is, there are 10% of the people out there who are going to pass no matter what question is asked, and they're probably not sitting here, they're probably out having fun, right? There are also something more than 10% of people, maybe a third, who are going to fail no matter what question is asked, all right? And hopefully none of you are included in those. In the middle, we take it as a bit of a personal affront as teachers and instructors and tutors and exam setters and exam markers. We take as an affront every one of you who fails, right? Because we've failed too. And so far from a curve that suggests we should be failing some more people, we do look at, we don't actually graph the curves, but we do look at the distributions, and sometimes it's a bit like a normal curve. Sometimes, sort of more frequently, it is a strange curve, and sometimes it'll be bimodal. There's people who are around 40% and just didn't get it, and there's more people around 60% who did get it, right? And so you've got that sort of bimodal one and not very many in the middle. The problem for examiners, of course, is where you've got the mode of your distribution right near the pass mark. And that makes hard work, as has been discussed. But we are certainly not expecting anything like a normal curve. And the only time I can remember reacting to that sort of idea was when we had, if you like, too few passes, and we went, this question must be harder than we think it is. We'll have to reassess here and have another look and go back and talk with the markers about whether this question really is harder for people in their 20s than it is for people who are 40, right? And why we are failing so many. That's the only time I can remember sort of marking to a curve.
And that's happened for CAP once in the 5 years I've been involved.
Yeah.
And we do 10 questions a year, so it's one out of 50. So,
no, general insurance, we don't mark to a curve. The pass mark is the pass mark. If you hit the pass mark, you pass, unless you're a borderline fail or a borderline pass. The other thing, very important, it's in everyone's interest for you to pass. It's in the institute's interest for you to pass because they collect more fees from you as a fellow. It's in your employer's interest for you to pass because, you know, they can collect more fees from their clients because now you're qualified. It's in all of our interest as actuaries for you to pass because you can then make a positive contribution to society as an actuary and enhance the reputation of the profession. That's good for all of us. So just keep that in mind. Everyone wants you to pass. All the help is out there for you to pass.
So why are you letting the team down?
Some of them might not be.
Maybe just to finish off as well, don't focus on that. Don't focus, because it's not in your control. What you can control is practicing and really understanding your content. Just focus on that.
Hi. At the front here. So my question is, if you have, say, 10 minutes left of the exam and you know you're not going to finish your question, what would you suggest we do to maximise marks?
So specifically for CAP, first of all, you've got 8 hours. If you run out of time... in 8 hours, that's a serious, you know, you just, it's different to the other exams. You really should not run out of time in CAP. You've got to be on top of your time management in CAP. You shouldn't run out of time. If you do in CAP, that is not a great outcome, but I would, if I've only got 10 minutes, I would make sure my executive summary is as good as I can make it, because that's your best bang for buck in terms of words on a page for marks, essentially. I'll let the others answer for the other exams.
I was just going to say, whether it's 10 minutes to go or whether you're mid-exam and you find yourself in a situation where you've read it, the question, you're like, I just can't think of any ideas, right? So you're just stuck for ideas. The two things that I used to always go back to, like idea generators, is who are the stakeholders in the situation and what are the key risks? If you can, they're very good idea generators. So if you just go back to that, if you're under pressure or running out of time, that usually help. Yeah.
If you're doing CAP, you've got 10 minutes, go out, get some food for 5 minutes. At the same time, ask them to print the thing out for you. So once you've had something to eat, which is important because it gets you refreshed and you perform much better in the remaining 5 minutes than you would otherwise perform in the 10 minutes. Come back, the person's printed the thing out for you, have a proofread, identify where you need to beef up your answer, especially in the exec summary, and then make some edits and hope for the best. If it's a specialist exam, like, 3B, 3A, go back to the questions and see. So you do two things. One is proofread. Secondly, go back to the questions and see which question has the most number of marks that you think you can get the most marks out of, and go answer that.
Two thoughts. The first one is, if you're running out of time, meaning it's not that you don't have enough to write, but rather it's that you've got too many things to write and you don't have enough time to write them down. Do a little bit of everything. Don't just finish question parts A and B of the question and don't touch question C, right? Make sure you get the easy marks. If that means doing half of A and half of B and half of C, you achieve two things. Firstly, it's easier to get the first half of the marks than it is to get the rest. And secondly, you have completed the question by getting to the important judgmental type part at the end. My second point, I don't know exactly how much you see from examiners' reports. I know that censored versions of them are made public, but if you read between the lines of them in the last couple of semesters, time pressure has been too great. Put yourself in the examiner's shoes again, and I would like to think that these next couple of semesters the examiners will adjust a little and time pressure won't be as bad.
I think following on from some of those points as well, is just think back to the basics, structure. How would I set the question out, and what are the material items? So putting down the most important points and doing that for each of the individual questions, you get a lot of the marks done, or a fair chunk of the marks done with the smallest amount of time, and then the rats and mice come with the most amount of time. It's like in a real job, get to the heart of the matter as quick as you can.
I would say for any discursive questions that you have left over that you haven't done yet, dot points. There are way too many answers I see that, just full of fluff, like lots of big paragraphs, unnecessary words. Dot points are fine, as long as you got to take it from the perspective of the marker. From the marker's perspective, we are told to find where we can give you points. So we're not out to go, haha, so you got this wrong, so that's a cross. We are there to try to give you the points as long as you can demonstrate and prove to us that you know what you're talking about. So dot points are more than fine. You don't need full sentences, especially if you're running out of time. For things that are, so for investments in particular, there are lots of mathematical and proof type questions. Some of those are very long. We do give points if you can just write out, if you only have 10 minutes, I would say, explain what you are going to do, even if you can't do it in that time. Partial marks are awarded for that. And if you go through the past papers, a lot of the solutions would kind of show the breakdowns of how the marks are allocated. So you can kind of see the thresholds that you have to achieve partial marks for each of those questions. So that gives you a fairly good guide as to where the easy marks are if you are running out of time.
And best of all is not to run out of time in the first place. So actually, I think it was it you, Chow, who said that you were 1.5? I was 1.6. So I was 1.6 minutes per mark. I was absolutely disciplined. It was the first thing, like in the specialist type exams, it was the first thing I did when I got into the room was to write out how many minutes I was going to spend on each question without even having read the question, just how many marks were available and therefore how many minutes, and I absolutely stuck to it and always had 15 to 20 minutes left at the end of the exam, to which you can then allocate in the most efficient way that you think.
Hi, I've got a question for Chow and Matt. So if it's like an Excel calculation question, it's like more often than not, like if there's one towards the end of the paper and I'm running out of time, can I just make up numbers and write a polite apology note on the side saying I have made up numbers, but I know like how to do it if I had more time and say how I would have done? How many marks would I get? Or do you think that's a good thing to do, just for the sake of getting to the later parts of the question, mainly?
I think it's what was just said. So if you say, here's what I would do, and write that out. But I've run out of time. Here's what I would do. List it out. You know, if it's a reserves question, you know, you've got to think about how do you build that up. You know, you've got claims, you've got expenses, you've got to allow for recoveries, a risk margin, et cetera, et cetera. So I know I've got to do all these things. I just don't have enough time. Absolutely, you're going to get marks for that. How much marks? I don't know. It depends on the question. It depends how many marks the question's worth. But definitely when I was marking, I gave students marks for that, whether they ran out of time or not. Even if you've not ran out of time, so you're in the midst of the question, and say you've carried forward an error into the rest of your calculation, I'm not going to keep penalising you. So I know where you've stuffed up. It's just that if the rest of your methodology is correct, that's fine. So you just get penalised once. Yeah.
An interesting question that raises is maybe I should make up a number and just blunder on anyway and not admit that I made up the number. And the answer is that's an extremely high risk idea. You might get away with it. You might, and we've seen examples, you might get sprung. And then instead of losing a few marks, we're going to say this is unprofessional behaviour. And this person's unlikely to pass. If you don't have the evidence and the track as to where your number came from and you suddenly burst out with a number, or others that we've seen are you're on the wrong track and you've suddenly burst out with a good answer, we have to suspect that you've had some wandering eyes across the corridor and come up with a good answer. And fitness to practice, do you want this person to be your partner in your business, right? So much better to do, as the gentleman described, say, I haven't got time, this is what I would do, I've made up this answer, but this allows me to go and do parts B, C and D of the question.
Practice in real life as well, in your real life job, to do back of the envelope calculations. Spend not much time, but get a reasonably accurate answer. We call it back of the envelope calculation. Has to make sense. You know, the data has to be robust. It has to be checked. You know, the numbers have to be real. The calculations have to be real, but they're just simplified versions of what you would do if you had time. And you would see some of your employers, some of your bosses do that to check your work. They would perform a back of the envelope calculation and say, this answer doesn't look right. What you've given me to review doesn't look right. Practice doing that. So in the exam, you can perform a back of the envelope calculation and it demonstrates that you know what you're doing.
I can't support that more. That's just learning to do back of the envelope calculations. You know all the old guys in the office can do it. And they didn't learn to do it last week. They learned to do it when they were your age, because things were, the
applications and so on were different back then, and we had to do things that way. But the skill is useful all the way through. So, it helps you in your exams, and it will help you all the way through your career. If you're able to look at someone's numbers and just go, that just does not look right, and I can show it's wrong in 5 minutes, that's a great skill to have. So practice that every time you see some numbers. So does it feel right?
Just following on from what Matt said, if you're able to do those back-of-the-envelope calculations, it actually shows you understand the material drivers of what makes up the number. So I spent a lot of my career reviewing valuations, so policy liabilities, capital, and embedded value. And very easily, you could make up quite simple rules of thumb. So someone would come to me with the value of new business, and I say, that's way out. I'd say, it should be 1.2 times your sales. What's changed? And they go, oh, yeah, I'll have a look at that. And they go and have a look at that, and they've made a mistake in the model. So just doing very simple ratio checks on what you're doing, and talking specifically in the context of life insurance, can really add. It adds flavor to what you produce. So it shows, I've done some work, I've done some high-level reasonableness checks, this is why I feel comfortable that it's right.
Sorry, I'm just going to make one more comment on that. I've seen, actually in the CAP paper, I have seen students from time to time say, here are my numbers, I know they're wrong, but I don't know why they're wrong. I haven't got time to work out why they're wrong, but I can see they are wrong. And that actually gets a lot of respect from the marker when you do that. Yep.
So hi, it's me again. Thanks for answering my question earlier. So I've got a question for all the panel members. So in first section, one of the biggest tips for passing exams to be aware of what's going on in the market. So I would like to ask each member, panel member, to name one hot topic in the practice area. And that will potentially be relevant for exams.
Yeah. No problem.
Potentially.
No problem. Anyone who's an examiner setting questions probably shouldn't answer that question.
I mean, I'm not setting setting any exams, but for general insurance, look at drones, look at cyber risk. They're all big topics at the moment. Chow mentioned CTP reform. You can ask anything. General insurance is good. You've got driverless cars. So many options.
Well, there's four. The three questions will be surely among those four, won't they? Fair question. Life insurance. Commission being restructured. The whole advice industry being restructured.
Changes to the accounting standards for life insurance. That's starting to become a big topic. What else? I think driverless cars is an interesting one for GI for sure. That would be one that I would be looking at. Customer behaviour for life insurance. I think that's probably something that has not got much attention in the past, but starts to become a bit more important
now.
Sorry,
can you be a bit more specific?
Customer buying behaviour. So it's customer buying behaviour and the behaviour of customers in leading to claims as well. Yeah, so psychology and those sorts of things sitting behind customer outcomes.
And I think just following on from that in life insurance, there has been papers released on it. You've seen a lot of things around claims management practices, philosophies, use of data analytics, even thinking wider, what does that mean for market, who are going to be the market participants? In terms of providers of insurance and consumers of insurance.
Channels, distribution channels in life insurance, I think is an interesting one.
I might add something to the fray as well. Just look at how you actually source your information and where you're getting it from. So APRA was mentioned as a source of information, that's great. In your company, you might also have other sources of information. So if your company is a big player in the industry, you might get a regular regulatory update. And so some of you might know this already, but tomorrow Suncorp, IAG and QB are all appearing at Parliament House for a general inquiry into banking and financial services. So that's a good topical area. There are internal sources of information all of you here will have through your company. And then another point would just be AFR might not be very specific enough for, say, insurance, whether life or health. So look at other sources. Consultants are always trying to sell their wares and sell information, right? So usually there'll be general bits of information that can be quite helpful. Affinity produces a pendulum report on GI. So I work in GI, so my knowledge is limited to that, but I'm sure there are parallels in life, health, and the like. So look at where you source it from beyond just, say, traditional mainstream media.
Also, conference schedules are good. So what are the hot topics at the conferences this year, last year, next year?
Yeah, the actuaries, what do you call it? Summit. Yeah, that's happening. So once that's happened, you can get on your member paywall on the website. You can listen to all of the recordings of all of the, you know, things that people have presented. You can check out their presentations. Chances are there's a lot of hot topics, otherwise they wouldn't be presenting, right? They'd be wasting their time. And also, not to get your hopes down, none of us set the exam paper. The writer, so how the thing is structured is there's an exam writer, they write the questions, then we review it. So as assistant examiners and examiners, we review the questions, we sort of try to tweak and so on, see whether it's a good question, whether it's a fair question, and so on. The markers then go and mark, scrutineers go and do the questions. So we don't set the questions. And if I were a writer, I wouldn't be blatant enough to just say CTP reform, right? I wouldn't just pinch the CTP reform and say, you know, in La La Land, they're trying to reform the compulsory third parties. No, I wouldn't do that, right? I'd look at the context of the issues that's behind the real issue, right, CTP reform, and try to make a question that sort of looks like it, but it's not the same. That is, if you don't know about, if you haven't thought about the real life issue, you wouldn't know what this question is talking about.
Think about the timing of some of these issues. I quite like the idea of looking at the program for the upcoming summit. Although the summit isn't until after your exams are on, the program is out already, it's up on the website, and people have chosen to write papers or to speak about particular topics because it has been topical over the last 6 months, right? Very much the same areas that the examiners are looking at. And so look at the topics that are there for your subject area, and if you're not particularly up on each of them, have a chat to somebody, a more senior person that you work with or a colleague somewhere, and say, hey, what's the issues here, right? So you at least understand what it is, because over the last 6 months, this has been an issue. Some things, though, are not an issue. I remember sitting superannuation, and the day before the final tutorial, the stock market crashed by about 50%, right? The 1987 stock market crash, and now you know how old I am. And we all sat in the institute tutorial and said to the tutor, hey, you know, how does this change what might be in the exam? And she said, oh, the answer's easy. The exam question was written weeks ago, so you don't have to worry about this, right? Besides which, it's a short-term thing. Actuarial thinking's meant to be rather longer term than daily stock market crashes.
In our guide, in our brief for this session, we'll have a little bit of time after this for people to approach the panelists individually, and hopefully we've broken the ice a little bit. These guys aren't too scary, I think. But I'd like to firstly thank everyone for their attendance in the panel to start with. Thanks very much, guys.